Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to another episode of our Aging Gayfully podcast. I'm your host, Christopher McClellan, and I am really delighted and excited to have Drew Pickett, who is an associate professor at Indiana State School of Public Health, as my guest today. Drew, welcome.
Hey, Christopher, how's it going? And you gave me a promotion there. So
I did.
One of these days, I'd love to be an associate, but right now I'm an assistant professor.
Assistant. Well, you see, it tells me that I need to have my eyes checked again. So, that's part of the aging process.
Hey, if you want to give me tenure, I will take that.
Where do I write the letter? Because I know the work that you're doing is so important and so needed. And not only in just the LGBT community, but focusing on family caregivers that are dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia. So welcome.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. Absolutely.
So there's a lot of ways I could go with our conversation today, but I think people want to know your why. Why does this area of focus so important to you, dementia, Alzheimer's, and especially as it relates to our LGBT community?
Sure, absolutely. You know, I think that I took kind of a very roundabout approach to ending up where I am. I was actually in a whole other field and doing a whole other thing, and actually had gotten that promotion and that tenure and sort of started over in my career in a lot of ways to come do some work that I'm passionate about with people here at IU who are really doing some cool stuff. I'm in a department, we're called the Department of Health and Wellness Design, and we've got a group of us now that are really focused on developing tools and supports, structures to help caregivers. Particularly for us, it's mostly in the dementia space, but of course there's some commonalities that go across that, you know, by condition. But also as I got here, I started working with a number of really great folks who have been in this space and building these tools for a little while. And the question we kept asking, and there are a few of us in different lanes, was, but do they work for everybody? Does this work for LGBT folks? Was the question that I kept coming to. You know, what does this mean when your family structure looks a little bit different? How does that operate? Who's the person that's filling those gaps? But we have other folks who are doing this with Latino populations and racial minorities of all kinds. We're really focused on sort of the equity questions as well. Sort of like, it's hard enough being a caregiver, but some caregivers have additional burden to bear. And I think in my case, a lot of that question has come around sort of how are we supporting LGBT families through some tough times, some real challenges.
Well, you've taken me back to my days in social work when you said gaps in services. We used to look at that critical aspect in order to fill those gaps, because it is important to find the data in order to procure the results. And it's easier said than done, but you are on top of it.
Well, I think that's sort of what I see as my part to play in the story. I was never, you know, the person who could be that social worker on the ground. That wasn't my strength set. But I love data and numbers and learning about things and providing sort of that level of understanding. And we do take this stuff to legislators and to organizations. I mean, we're working with small businesses and major organizations as well, but also have projects where we're working with our local city to create new policy. So, I mean, I think that anybody who's making those decisions, whether it's business, whether it's government, they are looking for a good, solid reason for that.
Right.
They need good data behind it. And so that's the gap that we're hoping to fill, is that knowledge gap of sort of saying, okay, we sort of intuitively know that there are these challenges in caregiving or in anything, really. But let me give you the data to prove it and to say that this is a real thing that we really have to address today.
And I think the old social worker in me always wants to wrap themselves around the stories behind the data. But actually, they go really hand in hand, because one supports the other. You know, we've learned over the years that the data really helps the legislators, the decision makers, in allocating the funds for the services. But it's those stories that come in, and that's where we really excel, and the Whole Care Network and Aging Gayfully is sharing the stories that helps lend a personal story to each one of those data entries.
Oh, absolutely. And it's it's a strange position to be in on this side of it when, you know, I talk to so many folks and my team talks to so many folks. We do interviews and conversations with caregivers, and I see this big aggregation of just dozens or hundreds of stories. And mm-hmm. and there are commonalities. There are things that everybody's right. kind of going through, and then everybody's got these sort of unique spins or a funny story that gets thrown in. And it's just, it really personalizes sort of what we're doing. And the why question you asked really is for those folks and the things that they're dealing with in life, and how can we support them?
Yeah, I've learned over the years that it's through story sharing where diversity meets the road to collaborate on a common cause. And absolutely. I firmly believe caregiving is the one social issue that brings people together from diverse backgrounds, because there's no boundaries when it comes to caregiving. And it impacts everybody, Black, white, gay, straight. Absolutely. There might be some cultural differences as it relates to caregiving, but people connect from diverse experiences and backgrounds through their caregiving stories. And we find out, you know, we're really not that much different from one another. We all want to care for the person that's entrusted in our care the best as possible.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, across the things you mentioned, but it's every human experience. And I'm thinking of one of our folks here who also has a bunch of work that she's doing with caring for children who have, you know, medical complexity and lots of medical right. issues. So it's not just, you know, race or sexual orientation. It's also age. And I mean, I think when we think about providing care, sometimes it's long-term, sometimes it's short-term. I mean, if I fall and break my leg, who's going to be the person to mm-hmm. get me around? I mean, they're short, you know, so there's a lot of different ways that this can manifest. And some of it does have those sort of shared experiences and the shared needs of caring for cancer versus kids versus dementia. Those things, some of those things will be very similar, and sometimes it's very, very different. And so trying to understand and parse out sort of those differences too is a big part of our conversations, is understanding those things.
Yeah, very much so. And so I the question that I will pose to you, because I got this posed to me all the time, and you know, what's different about being an LGBT caregiver?
Yeah, you know, I think especially most of my work right now is in the dementia space. So we're dealing with a little older population, lots of older adults at the moment. And the cohort of older adults who are also LGBT right now have lived through a lot.
Yeah.
And a lot of discrimination, a lot of stigmatization, a lot of medical challenges. I mean, you think about the HIV crisis, the AIDS right. crisis. So I think the current cohort of older adults, of LGBT older adults, probably looks a little bit different than right. say, mm-hmm. their cisgender heterosexual counterparts in a lot of ways. And their family structures may look different. And, you know, for example, in dementia, we know that most of the time, the caregiver tends to be either a spousal partner or an adult child. Mm-hmm. And in the case of LGBT older adults, statistically speaking, we're less likely to have either one of those things.
Very much so. Yeah.
And so who's filling that care gap? If it's not the sort of traditional route, who are those folks who are filling that gap? And how do we support those folks? Because maybe their caregiving journey is different. I mean, you think about all the ways, I know you and I have talked in the past about your green folder project.
Right.
And that green folder that you carried around with all those documents to prove your relationship. If your relationship isn't a marriage, if it isn't an adult child, you do have to have those documents. You do have to have all those things in place. And the law, as it currently is written, especially depending on where you live, I mean, I live in Indiana, you live in Florida.
Yeah.
I think, you know, depending on where you are and what you're doing, that can radically change the documents that have to be in that folder, just to be able to get in the room to make the decisions for your loved ones. And so I think there's, you know, there's definitely, like I said, there's things that are the same. The experience of having a loved one go through the symptomology of whatever condition, whether it's dementia, whether it's cancer, it's HIV, that's hard to watch. There are certain challenges and symptoms that are hard to deal with. Those things are common, but then there's some added challenges sometimes for LGBT folks in terms of sort of planning for all those things and the eventualities.
Very much so, and specifically relating to the older LGBT community who has come out of a system of, let's just say that lack of support There,
Absolutely.
when you go back, just in the 15 years since my partner was diagnosed with esophageal cancer, what little information there was then as compared to now. But when we think back to the Stonewall era and HIV, how little the information was and how guarded today's seniors were about sharing their information, in fear of being outed or not accepted. And those plays a big role in people's health care decisions that is often left misunderstood by people that are not within our community.
Sure, absolutely. You still see, for example, there are gaps in sort of population level people who identify as LGBTQ. The older adults are less likely to identify as such publicly, right? Right. And a lot of that's due to history. I mean, I don't think that magically people are changing. I think it's that younger generations are potentially a bit more comfortable in sharing those things and responding to a survey question that asks about your sexual orientation or your gender identity and marking that in a way that someone else will see it. And we see this playing out in sort of medical settings of this history of discrimination and mistrust and sort of trying to understand how to navigate systems and how open to be. And how that may or may not impact the care that your partner receives. I mean, that's a lot of background questions to be asking that you don't want to deal with when you're also dealing with a dementia diagnosis or a cancer diagnosis. And it's funny, I work with students a lot. I am in a university setting, and our IU undergraduates, it's really interesting sometimes to sort of see how fast the needle has moved sometimes. Most of them have not now have lived almost their entire sort of adult or late adolescent life in a post Obergefell world. And so it's almost shocking sometimes to them to see the dates of sort of how recently sexual activities were legalized or marriage equality existed, or even, you know, civil partnerships before that were controversial in this century. And so, I mean, I think that there's a lot has changed very quickly, but there's a huge generation or a huge number of folks for whom the world has sort of changed around it, and sort of trusting that change is still a challenge.
All right. We're in, you know, quite a very interesting time politically and socially, economically as well. But I do think that, and I really believe this, why it's so exciting to talk to somebody like you who's on the front lines of education. I do think that the future is bright. People that are in their kids, listen to me, kids, you know, the students that are in their 20s going through college right now, they're up on these issues and they see it. They're the ones who are going to foster the change for folks like myself who, you know, who's probably going to need a caregiver 10 years down the road.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And it is so inspiring to see in my classes and you know, our students and the questions that they ask and the things that they want to know about and the things that they, honestly, sometimes the things that they take for granted, that's almost inspiring in a lot of ways, that it doesn't occur to them that marriage equality didn't exist.
It's something they've all known, right?
It's just been their lived experience. And the notion that it could go away doesn't cross their mind. And that's a lot of times. For some, it does. But for a lot, it seems that it doesn't really cross the mind even. And so that, to me, in some ways is uplifting and exciting, because there doesn't seem to be that open antagonism in this generation. But also it's a little bit scary you know, we got to stay vigilant on certain things as well.
Right. And there's so many important components to marriage equality and why I'm such a big advocate of it. And there's an area that very sensitive to talk about, but it's so important to talk about is, you know, the rights granted upon marriage are transferable upon death.
Absolutely.
And, you know, when you're standing there saying, I do, you're not really thinking about 30, 40 years down the road when one of your partner gets sick and you have to have these documents in place. And marriage really ties all, no pun intended, marriage really ties all the knots together.
Absolutely. And it does it in a single, like one fell swoop, right? It does it all at once. Whereas sort of piecemealing together all the different rights and privileges and things of marriage, if you want to do it outside of that framework, legally speaking, right, is extremely challenging. And setting up all the different sort of powers of attorney and all the legal, like, it's not an easy thing to do. And so marriage sort of does that neatly.
Marriage kind of does it neatly. And that's why we don't really want to lose that right. But, another real critical aspect that really plays in as to the LGBT community as well, and you're kind of focusing on this, is the financial burden.
Sure.
I mean, that's, I look back at those bills from the hospital and thankful that we had good insurance, but not everybody does.
Oh, absolutely. And to your question very, very early on about sort of what makes it a little bit different for LGBT folks, it's not just the sort of stigmatizing potential experiences or the legal recognition. There's actually a financial component. I mean, I think population-wide, we do know that LGBT folks are across their lifespan, make less money on average, are less likely to be in full-time jobs that have those benefits. And even if they do, the question of marriage comes up again. And right, is your insurance shared with your partner? Are they able to purchase in on that? Are they able to be covered by that? At what level? And so the finances of it do play in. So that LGBT folks tend to, again, more often than not, congregate in sort of cities that tend to have higher cost of living.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so to avoid certain things and certain potential discrimination, you're also living in a place where financially it's a little bit tougher. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of sort of hidden cost in some ways that sort of plays in as well. Like, it's not just legal, it is also a financial question. Planning for medical care and for caregiving broadly, financially speaking, is extremely challenging. I mean, there's very few families in general in the country that are financially ready to take on something like a dementia diagnosis.
And right,
long-term care is for dementia, you're oftentimes looking at a 10-year or more disease progression.
Exactly.
And so being financially prepared for that duration of care is extremely rare. Very few people. And then if you add that into sort of subpopulations that are economically disadvantaged, regardless, whether that's LGBTQ folks or racial minorities, right, it compounds that challenge for sure.
I get to use my pet phrase with you that I've used for years now. I said, Drew, have you met anybody in your research that's had caregiving on their bucket list of things to do in life?
No, I can't. No. I don't think I can point to a single one who said this was what I really wanted to do. I will say it's fascinating. There's a new body of literature. I think right now we're sort of thinking through a little bit of the framing that we've had around caregiving in the research mm-hmm. world has been right. very, very, very negative. We look at the burden, the challenges, and how it's bad for your stress levels and your health and your, all the different health behaviors that you don't have time for, right? Eating right and exercising and getting enough sleep, and these are bad for your health. And we kept documenting these challenge. But there's some really great stuff coming out as well, though, that does talk a little bit about sort of the joy of caregiving
right.
and the closeness that people feel to their care recipient, new levels to a relationship. I think you and I have had a little bit of a conversation about like a new level of intimacy that occurs mm-hmm. when you're caring for somebody. And so there, I don't want to paint caregiving as this broadly negative thing, but again, I don't think it's on somebody's radar. It's like, I really want to do this with my life.
Right. It's an unplanned event in most cases. It's an unfortunate accident or an untimely diagnosis. And suddenly you're thrust into this role that most people are not prepared for. You're right. dealing with systems that are unfamiliar, whether it's the healthcare, the legal. I mean, there's just one after another. But then there is, and I can speak firsthand to this. There is some beautiful moments in it, and you recognize that, unfortunately, more so once caregiving ends. Sure. Then while you're in the midst of it, because there's two very common aspects to caregiving. There's a beginning and there's an ending, and we're not prepared for either one of these life-changing events. But when you look back on your experience, the good days, you've usually far outweighed the bad days. It's just those bad days were so intense. Right. And that's what, as I perceive the work that you're attempting to do here, is that's what's going to, you're going to help those bad days be a little bit easier by gathering the data and getting systems in place, identifying the gaps in services, and getting the legislature to acknowledge that these gaps are there so that people can be better served.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's really our big goal. This is, we know these challenges are going to come up, and we know that there are certain challenges that are common across caregivers. Mm-hmm. And if we can at least address those, if we can start to provide a way to support people so that those bad days are a little less bad, that they can get access to a resource they need, whether that's, financial or just respite care, or even just, learning how to leverage that emotional support in your social network. So, like, there are a lot of different ways that we can go about addressing this. Right. And I think some of the programs and the structures that we've proposed out of our group are at kind of different levels. Some of them are very individual. It's sort of training the individual on how to navigate some of these things. And some of it is taking this information back to policymakers. And so we kind of run the gamut of, and sometimes it's working with organizations somewhere in the middle. Here's a product that maybe you could offer that caregivers might use and need and leverage. Right. And so I think that's our goal, though, is to figure out which ways or whatever modality works, that's the one I want to use. There. I want to get the help to folks. And so figuring out where those needs are and then identifying and sort of testing the best way to get the support that people need to them.
So I know you're working with a wonderful small business, Care Virtue, to kind of bring the issues to the forefront in a study that you're coordinating with the university. And we're looking for participants. It's real important for people to share their stories so that this data can help those who are in need of assistance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a few things there. One, I just cannot sing the praises of Care Virtue enough. And they're a great organization and great small business that's been working with some of the members of our team for a little while now on providing care support. So the original Care Virtue platform is available. It's online. It is a sort of care coordination platform for a dementia caregiver, centered around a dementia patient.
Right.
Their network can come together and share information, a shared calendar, and sort of a space to post, a wall almost to post on, sort of what's going on in that care recipient's life, what symptomology is present today, what experiences did they have that were really great, what do we want to share amongst the cohort to help plan care together, mm-hmm. and sort of share the burden. So that was the sort of base platform. But what we're doing now is sort of adding in some additional features that people, that we noticed that people started to need more and more of. One of those areas was legal and financial planning.
Right.
So I know we've come up on that a few times, and it's not fun to talk about. But it is a very real need for caregivers to understand, especially in the context of dementia, where you see cognitive capacity declines,
right.
which means one's capacity to assign over attorney or any kind of, to enter into marriage, to protect right. some asset. All those things are a challenge the longer that we go on. And so we're trying to find ways to teach people about these things early. And to provide support for setting up early the right structures that will help you plan for the future, right? And so this Care Virtue Planner is the tool. That's the name of the tool that we've been developing. We're running right now our first test of that product. And it's broadly available for any caregivers of people with dementia. But we are actually especially interested in recruiting. And we got some extra funding from the National Institutes of Health. This is a priority of the National Institutes of Health, by the way, to
Very good.
Promote LGBTQ health. And so we got some extra funding to specifically test whether this product is working for LGBTQ families and if it's addressing the unique concerns that they face. So that way we get that information. We see where the gaps that we've provided this information on power of attorney, but it didn't tell you how to set this up in your state
right.
for a same-sex couple. Now we have a data point where we can say, okay, we need to go back and add content so that if this person meets these criteria, it's able to adjust it to their unique need. So we're trying to recruit folks right now for that study to basically spend a few months using it and testing out its features and reading through the content and setting yourself up legally and financially for that care journey. And then giving us a little bit of feedback on what works and what doesn't.
I know the answer to this question, but I want to ask it anyway.
Sure.
I've mentioned this many times in presentations over the years. Why is it so important for our community to complete these surveys?
Yeah. So again, I think I sort of hinted at this earlier. Is there's a lot of research mistrust in the LGBTQ right. community, and I was just commiserating with a faculty member just yesterday, who does a lot of work in HIV research as well. And it can be a challenge because, frankly, in the past, systems and structures, universities, government have not been the best about operating in an ethical manner with respect to the LGBTQ community. So getting people over the hump of doing that can be a challenge. But that information is super important, and it allows us to create products and get data and information to inform policy and things
right.
in a way that is responsive to the LGBTQ folks. We can't argue that the data says this if we don't have those stories.
We don't have,
keep talking right.
Exactly.
If we don't have that data, then we can't make those arguments. And we don't understand what we don't know yet. You know, you asked what's different about LGBTQ caregiving. And I have intuition, and there's some data
yeah.
that says certain things, but there's not a lot yet. It's still a very new space, and we are trying to fill that void with actual real information, with high quality information. So it's not relying on, you know, Drew's intuition about what products we need or what laws we need to pass, but instead on the shared stories of lots
on
of people
the stories. Yeah.
and their
yeah.
experiences and finding those common experiences that we can yeah. build around.
And that's why I'm so excited to be involved in this with you and Care Virtue, because of, you know, my specialty is sharing the stories, is getting the stories and matching it to the data. Your pet specialty is getting the data, and it's just really a perfect fit for collaboration here, because I think as we demonstrate how we're collaborating together on this important study, more people will step up and share their experiences, so the caregiver that's coming behind them will have a little bit better information as they move through
Absolutely.
Their care journey as well. Goodness, Drew, I have a feeling this isn't our only podcast we're going to be doing over the foreseeable
not.
Future, but we're off to a roaring start for sure. But
Great.
Let all of our viewers and listeners know how they can get in touch with you. And of course, I will have all the contact information about the how to apply for the study and Care Virtue and our contact information in the show notes. But I know everybody wants to hear it from you too. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I will plug, you know, we've got kind of two big things going on right now. One is that Care Virtue study that we're looking for, you know, legal and financial planning. But the other question that's been on our minds recently is who's filling that care gap and what do those social networks look like? So we're actually running a second study as well that asks people really just who's in your social network? And then we're going to basically be able to figure out what these networks look like instead if we don't have that traditional adult child or spousal partner. Who's filling those gaps? So we've got kind of two things going on. And I know I've provided you links to both of them that can be, you know, sort of save those there. But you know, if you search for me at IU, again, I think I gave you the link to that.
Yeah, it'll be all available in the show notes.
All available and, there in the show notes. Because the remembering an email address is never easy. But
it's never easy, and of course,
if you reach out to those two email addresses that are in the show notes, our folks will get in touch. We want to hear stories about both of those, and both of those, by the way, I will make sure to note that it is an ethical thing as well. Those are paid research opportunities.
We are committed
to making sure that if you're going to spend the time sharing your story, we want to compensate you for that.
We do want to emphasize this is a paid study. You will be compensated for sharing your information, and your information is safe and secure. Drew?
Safe, secure, all of that.
You're pretty awesome. Thanks for the work that you're doing. And I so appreciated this conversation, and already looking forward to our next one whenever we're going to schedule it, which I hope is soon after your vacation. Of course.
Yes. I much needed break at the end of the week here. So looking forward to that. But okay. Yeah, no, absolutely. We'd love to be back.
Okay.